You're listening to Japan Baseball Weekly. News, interviews, analysis, and hot takes about all 12 NPB teams. Hosted by Jim Allen and John E. Gibson.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of February 20th. I'm John Gibson, and this should be a super fun show with my partner Jim Allen on a Saturday night. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
I'm not freezing, and baseball's going on, and football season's kind of over, but we got the NBA stuff, so I should be okay, and I'll get my highs and fixes on hockey and all that other stuff, so I'll be all right. I'll be all right, man. Don't worry about me. I'm okay.
I was concerned. I had the sports withdrawal syndrome hotline on my speed dial here, just in case you might keel over, but you've reassured me. I'm putting the phone down as
well. Text it to me anyway. Just text it to me anyway, man. Text it to me. Send it right now. Just okay. To be safe. Just to be safe. You never know when I might get hit. But anyway, yeah, doing okay, and everything's getting going here. We got the WBC coming up. We've got all kinds of things to talk about. And in fact, on this week's show, we've got a chat with Sarah Langs of MLB.com. And we're going to look at the top 10 Japanese major league players throughout the year. So that should be fun. We're going to take a look at MPB camp, Samurai Japan camp, and then hit some high heat. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
All right, so Sarah Langs is with MLB.com. She's a researcher and reporter and appears regularly on the Baseball Tonight podcast. And I guess I would call her a statistical / researcher context interpreter. How's that?
That's good.
You like that? Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it's going to be tough to put on her business card, but yeah.
It might not fit. It might not fit, but I have listened to that podcast for years, and I was telling her how when I was out running one day, when I think it was Alan Schwartz years ago was the host, and he used to call it the fastest 14 minutes. Yeah, the fastest 14 minutes in baseball, he used to call it, and I was out jogging, and I'm like, hey, I should be doing something like that with Jim, because we have some great conversations. And that was 13.
That was much longer than 13 years ago. It took me about 5 years to pull my leg far enough to get me to do it.
No, it just seems like that because you were disinterested at the beginning. But even with your disinterest, I was like the lead dog in a Iditarod. I just kept pulling the sled. And it wasn't that long because when I said, let's do it, I got going, got everything in motion. But it's not about us. It's about this show. And anyway, about Sarah, I think a lot of people might know her story. She really is a special gift to baseball. And for those of you who don't know about her, please look it up. There's aspects of her daily life that might require a Herculean effort for her to do. So we absolutely appreciate it. And it was a great honor for her to take time out of the evening on a Thursday to talk about this for us. She does a lot of statistical research, and she does a lot of number-based presentations on Baseball Tonight, so we had her do the same for us. So let's take a listen. All right, joining us this week is the incomparable Sarah Langs, who is a reporter and researcher with MLB.com, and she often appears on the Baseball Tonight podcast, and she's just fantastic. Thank you very much for taking time out of your hectic schedule to join us.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for the very kind intro, and thank you for having me. This is definitely the furthest away from where I've been sitting that I've talked to someone on a podcast, and you know what, that's a very exciting landmark, so thank you so much.
Oh, great that you could make time. So it's great to meet you, and in fact, it's an honor because I've been listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast for more than a decade, throughout its iterations. It's now called Baseball Tonight, but and I'm kicking myself because I'm sitting here thinking, man, we should have invited you on long ago to get some more insight and some numbers about the guys who play here in MPB and then go over to the major leagues. But what we do is basically when those guys graduate, let's say from Japan, we let them go. Yeah, you know, we cut the umbilical cord and we focus on the players who are here in Japan. So that's probably one of the reasons, but I'm kicking myself. We should have had you on before. Anyway, I know you have a hectic schedule, so let's get right to it. So I was sitting around the other day and I was looking at some old, I think it was 2009 WBC highlights of Japan and how the team did really well. And I looked at the roster and it just had so many guys who either eventually ended up in the major leagues or were currently in the major leagues at that time. And I thought, well, you know, a lot of people didn't think Japan was going to win. And even this year, you know, Japan takes this tournament as serious as many countries, a lot of Latin countries take the World Cup. So they're in it to win it and take heads, not even take names. So so these guys, I guess throughout the years now, especially since the WBC, Japan has built up a really good resume of players who have gone to the major leagues and played. So our exercise this week is for Sarah to rank from 1 to 10 the top Japanese players whose only their major league resumes, and let's see where everybody falls. So go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So I love a good list, of course, and number one is easy. It has to be Ichiro. He's going to be in the Hall of Fame shortly. Retired, of course, in 2019 after that amazing just situation with the two games in Japan against the A's, all of that. So it's funny because playing those extra two games set his Hall of Fame clock back a whole extra year, right? Because he played in two games and then retired. Retired at the end of 2018, which is basically when he stopped playing, it'd be different. But anyway, it doesn't matter. He'll be there very, very soon. And I think he's far and away number one. And, you know, I will say, you and I were talking before we were recording about kind of numbers and eye tests and that combination. And I agree with you. I'm going to paraphrase what you said, which is the idea of combining both, you know, not just going straight numbers. So I have in front of me the list of 1 through 10 and onward of most WAR of players who were born in Japan and played in the major leagues. But I really think that when we're looking at these players, it's not a straight counting stat sort of situation. Because obviously, especially with these players, even though we're only ranking them based on what they did in the majors, you do have to consider the fact that they played somewhere else beforehand. Their careers may not have begun at 20 and 21 years old in the majors the way players often do now. So because of that, a counting stat is not exactly the way that we want 1 through 10 to go. So I say that to preface that I think my number 2 is Hideki Matsui. Now, by numbers, it's Yu Darvish. Yu Darvish has the second most WAR of any Japanese-born player to play in the majors. And I think I have him third, but the main reason that I'm not putting him second yet is because that career still is in progress. Yeah, and so I think for him, part of what I see with Matsui is the impact that he had, you know. When he came over to the U.S., it was just 2 years after Ichiro had come over. And at that point, there was still this thought of, okay, you've proven that someone who is an amazing Hall of Fame level hitter in Japan can have that translate to the U.S. But we didn't know if the slugging would still be there. I mean, logic tells you it should be. But Matsui was the first real slugger to come over and have sustained success. So I am giving some extra points for those intangibles, for the character he was and the impact he had. And I also have a best friend since kindergarten named Hideko, which is, of course, the female version of Hideki. Big Yankees fan, so that was always her player. But I think that's a really important part of the impact that he had. So I have him at number 2, even though the numbers might not indicate as such. Now, at 3, as I alluded to, I do have Yu Darvish. And a lot of that has to do with time spent. So again, 10 years pitch, 11 years actually in the majors with one missed due to injury entering 2023, and another 6 years tacked on to that as of a couple weeks ago. It is amazing how many professional seasons he will have played in total. I mean, across the two, whenever he is done. And I mean, I would believe it if somehow we get a 1 year deal after that 6 year deal is up. I mean, it's hard to imagine him not pitching, but he has just been so good for so long, you know, kind of quietly with the Rangers for a while, and then much more on a national stage with being traded toward the end of 2018, I guess that was, and then to the Dodgers. Maybe that was end of 17. Excuse me.
End of 18, and then they went to the World Series, and he's still not welcome in Los Angeles because of that. But yes.
and then of course the time with the Padres now. I mean, I was tweeting when he signed that deal, but the September of 2022 was the second best month of his career by pretty much every stat: opponent batting average, ERA, WHIP, you name it. This is a guy who has been pitching in the majors since 2012. And overall, as a professional for much longer than that, has been really, really good, has been on Cy Young lists, you name it. And he had his second best month ever last year. I just think that's really impressive, and that sustained success is really, really important. Now, is it too much starting of Shohei Ohtani for? I mean,
I have him higher.
good. Again, I'm giving credit to impact and time spent, all of that. You know, he's only been here since 2018, but it's going to be a very interesting argument in 10 years between whether it's him or Ichiro at the top, because those are very different careers, and we'll see what Ohtani continues to do. Obviously, if he does what he did the last 2 years, for the next 10 years, it's him number one. If there are injuries or any slowing down on either side, then it's a discussion. But if he does this for 10 more years, he's a for sure first ballot Hall of Famer, the same way Ichiro is. But I mean, we know all of the amazing accolades, but last year was the first guy to qualify as a pitcher and a hitter in the same year. And that's really what stands out to me, is the fact that he has gotten to the point where neither of these are a sideshow. He's not pitching every now and then when he can. He's not only hitting well on the days he has been pitching. He's doing the thing. He's doing both at a very high level. I mean, it's amazing. Now I'm like, should he have been number two? But I'm going to give credit to history. I'm going to give credit to all that Yu Darvish has done. But man, Shohei Ohtani is absolutely amazing.
I would interject and say that if he does what he has been doing for 10 years, not 10 more years, just 10 years, gains success in there, he will surpass a lot of people. All right, who do you have next?
Since I didn't write out my list with the numbers, I'm doing it in my head. So I'm at four, so I'm at five now, I believe, yes. And I think I'm going to go with Hideo Nomo. I know that his career kind of had multiple acts, maybe. I know that there were times that he was really incredible and times less so, but overall, you know, I think that he also deserves a lot of credit for the impact he had, especially at the beginning of his career. And so much fun to watch at the beginning and in his prime, his major league prime. And obviously, I haven't even seen videos of other prime for him from NPB, but I'm sure it's just as incredible. But, you know, this is a guy who managed to lead his league in strikeouts twice. And he's on a very short list of guys to throw a no-hitter in your first start with a team, which he did with the Red Sox, I believe, the other other than in a major league debut. I believe there was a White Sox who did it in the 90s. So anyway, very short list, and more than just the Dodger that I think people remember him as. So again, maybe I'm giving credit to trailblazing and being that pitcher.
I do. I give a lot of credit to the trailblazing.
Absolutely. After him, I've got another pitcher. I've got Masahiro Tanaka. I think, I mean, you talk about sustained success. And, you know, maybe I am biased by living in the New York area. So seeing him and also getting a chance to cover him in 2019 with the Yankees. But he was so consistent. I think he was really important to that team during a time when they're pitching, you know, it's kind of pre-Garrett Cole, pre-really having the rotation they have now. And, man, he was beloved. I mean, fans loved him so much. And in that era where his social media presence was really a thing, I mean, people love his tweets and everything like that. And I love when a player whose first language isn't English is able to have that kind of connection with fans. So I think I have him next. How am I doing compared to your list?
Oh, you want to ask me my list? Well, we'll go through mine at the end, and I'll just
But I
kept doing my list, and the more I did it, I had to bump Masahiro Tanaka off my list.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I had to take him out of the top 10. This was really hard. At first, it started out to be a really fun exercise, and then it got mean.
I know, because I'm staring at these names and there are just so many to go through. I mean, I haven't even started to give credit to the relievers. And sure. So I think I need a reliever next. And I'm wondering if it should be Kazuhiro Sasaki, who I think is a little under remembered for also being Rookie of the Year, also being there a year before Ichiro, and I know that he didn't play in the majors for very long. But he played four seasons, he had 129 saves. Now, I know one of those teams won 116 games, but they were not all one-run wins. So I think that deserves a lot of credit. And again, I come back to the fact that we're evaluating this. We're evaluating partial careers. And I want to be sure that we are giving adequate credit to these amazing athletes for that. That even if we only got, as Major League Baseball fans, 4 years of a window into the athlete you are, we can go online, we can see who you were beforehand, and even if it doesn't directly factor in, it can be, oh my gosh, he was so good, and we got 4 years of that, and sort of having that kind of a perspective as well. I've lost track of what number I'm at.
Okay, so let's see. You got 2, 4, 6. Daimajin was his nickname. So Kazuhiro Sasaki was the 7th. So you're at 8.
Okay. All right. I only have 3 spots left. See, I see why this gets mean, right? I mean, this is... All right. I mean, all right. I am, again, I know, giving more credit here maybe to the impact than the overall stat line, but I can't have this list without having Daisuke Matsuzaka. I mean, and of course, you were talking about the WBC, and this doesn't factor into this list, but I was just going through all-time leaders in WBC stats. He has the most strikeouts. He's 6-0. In WBC games. I'm not a fan of wins for pitchers, but he made 6 starts and won all of them. So obviously his WBC stats don't apply here, but it speaks how dominant he really can be at times and was. And, I mean, there was nothing like that debut season that he had with the Red Sox. Obviously, team goes on to win the World Series, and just everything that he meant to that team. Again, we're giving credit for intangibles, things that nobody can measure, but he was such a sensation. So I have him there in number 8. I have 2 more left. I know they're going to be pitchers, and I'm thinking that we need to give credit to another reliever. I know I had Kazuhiro Sasaki, who, of course, had a shorter major league career, but racked up a ton of saves. But what about Koji Uehara, who I believe was on multiple World Series winning teams? I'll pull up his page and make sure I'm correct about that. No, I'm sorry, just the 2013 World Series with the Red Sox, but also a bunch of saves and a guy who was really, really good. I mean, anyone who pitches in relief for 9 years with a 2.66 ERA, pitching in high leverage situations, finishing games for just about half of the games he pitched in his career, really, really dominant in that span. And I actually remember I used to work with David Ross at ESPN. And, of course, the final World Series pitch that year was thrown by Koji Uehara because the Red Sox won at home. And we went to a game where Uehara was with the Cubs. And maybe in a working capacity, I'm not sure, maybe towards the tail end of his career. And Rossi brought the baseball from that final out to give to Koji so he would have it for his collection. And I just love players who are part of incredible, impactful moments like that. And my last player is going to be one that is totally not statistical, except that he was the first. And that is Masanori Murakami. My mother is a huge San Francisco Giants fan. She always told me about him growing up. And in retrospect, she probably started telling me about him back when Ichiro came over and all of the hype surrounding him when I was a young fan. And for him to have been the first, the sort of trade that went on and everything that went into that, I've read that Saber bio page and stories about him, you know, ad nauseum. And to see that we went from that to guys like Shohei Ohtani, Masahiro Tanaka, and guys, you know, playing this year, Kodai Senga, whoever, be able to say, okay, I want to go there. Let's figure it out, getting posted. And the situation we have now just shows how far we have come. But I always want to give credit to the original trailblazer.
Excellent. I thought about him, and I like I said, I think the numbers don't bear out for him.
Yes.
And we know he could pitch, but the time for me was...
Yeah, 2 years.
I think that was one instance, but it was so short. So, yeah, okay, I'll go through my list real quick, and then you can listen to my reasoning on the show when we...
Yeah.
Okay, but I've got Ichiro at the top. I've got Hideo Nomo number 2. I've got Shohei Ohtani number 3. I've got Darvish at 4. I've got Uehara at number 5. And part of it is because he had sustained success as a closer over there for so long after pitching both as a starter and closer over here in Japan. Then I have Hideki Matsui. Then I have Daisuke Matsuzaka. Then I have Hiroki Kuroda, whose efforts probably don't get enough value for a couple of reasons, but he played with some good teams. That's the other. That's one thing. And he pitched in the playoffs, and he was a pretty good playoff pitcher. Lockdown playoff pitcher. So I like that. Then I have Sasaki, and my 10th guy who bumped Masahiro Tanaka off simply because he pitched longer, and I thought he pitched on some maybe some teams that weren't as good, but he pitched well for them, and that's Shigetoshi Hasegawa. And I had forgotten about him, and I had forgotten about Uehara, and I had forgotten about Sasaki. But as I went through, like I said, I didn't do any research on the computer. I just went from what I call my baseball memory brain cabinet. Because we get force-fed a lot of baseball via NHK here in Japan, and those are the only games that are on TV as far as Major League games. So if you're going to watch, you either have the player or you have NHK, so you've got to watch. And so I just went on that stuff. And I just remember watching Hasegawa pitch for some marginal Angels teams. They were sometimes good. And some marginal Seattle Mariners teams. They were okay, but they were no great. And he was there, and he won games, and he pitched well. So I put him on the list and bumped off Masahiro Tanaka. So, Sarah, thank you so much. I can see you did a lot of homework. We really appreciate it. I always talk about football being compelling and basketball being exciting, and hockey is just plain cool. But you always say baseball is the best, and it is, and you are the best too. So thank you very much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me, and I love this. And, I can't wait to see what other players make their way up this list if we do it again in a few years, 5 years, 10 years, what have you.
Well, next time we will do the biggest busts of Japanese players. That would be fun too. And it's going to be a tough list as well. Okay, thank you very much. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
All righty. So I had to piece that together. Apologies again, Sarah. Just had some technical difficulties, but I think I am the technical difficulty. It's mostly me. But anyway, we were able to complete the interview, and we will try to get some video up on the YouTube channel. We're going to try to do more with that this year. But of course, I say we, and that's more of a Jim thing because he's more adept with the video than I am. Thank you, Jim.
Well, my pleasure, I think.
Don't make it sound like you're being force-fed. You got to keep saying, this is delicious.
Let's give it to Jim. He eats everything.
All right. So, look, I'll let you comment on Sarah's list, but I think yours is going to be more interesting than mine. Mine, I think listeners have heard already on that short side. I'll get to why I chose them, but I get it. I think it was a long time ago that Ken Kadokura, the pitcher, when he joined the Giants, and I told him, this is a really tough place to play. A lot of Giants fans only turn on the game at 9 o'clock to see who won. They don't care how. And Kadokura said to me, he said, John, there's a lot of ways to look at baseball. So why don't you tell us about your list, Jim? Or first comment on Sarah's list, and then tell us about your list, and then we'll go through.
Oh, I thought it was an interesting list, and I like, we're engaged in an impossible task to begin with, because, what's value? I don't want to go into what's value, but what's important? What's big? What's best? And it's different for everybody. It's different for every game. It's different for every season. It's different for every team and every player. But I did like her her mixing, her eclectic approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of had that, and I guess I hadn't thought about my friend Masanori Murakami, and my comment about that would be, he was a pioneer, but he was a pioneer by accident. He wasn't like he was trying to go to MLB. He just
right.
Like,
I think you told the story, but tell the story again for.
Well,
for
he was. It used to be a thing. It used to be a thing for Japanese teams to send their players who were not expected to be on the Japanese major league team to send them to the States to play in A ball, typically.
Mm-hmm.
This was common. It was common a long time ago, and in I believe 1964, three 64, 65, the Nankai Hawks arranged with the San Francisco Giants to have three of their young players go and play for the Fresno Bees in the Single A California League.
Okay.
And at the end of the season in September, of course, when the season, the minor league season is over and major league rosters are expanded, the teams will bring up minor leaguers, you know, to help out, you know, to get a MLB cup of coffee. And one of the players the San Francisco Giants selected was Masanori Murakami, which is, I mean, typically they don't go down as far as Single A, but he was pretty solid. And here's the catch. The typical minor league contract then said that the major league team can buy out any player who's not on the 40-man roster for $2,500. So the San Francisco Giants sent the Nankai Hawks a check for $2,500 and said, thanks for the pitcher. So
yeah, a great story. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, so he did there and he wanted to stay, but he wanted to stay in the States. But then when he went back to Japan, he signed a contract because he didn't really understand the way things worked. And and I don't understand the dynamic. He said it in Japanese really quickly, and I really don't understand it all that well. But and I haven't read Rob Fitz's book yet. Sorry, Rob. So I don't know the dynamics of how he ended up with a contract with the Hawks and his annual contract with the Hawks and a contract with the Giants, but it caused a lot of trouble. But after his first full season in MLB, it was essentially when MLB and Japan were going to go to war over it. And one team canceled its postseason. The Pittsburgh Pirates canceled their postseason tour of Japan. It was agreed that Murakami would go back for the following season. He would go, I think it was 1966 that he went back, and I think it was 1964 that the Pirates canceled their series. So it was a bit of a, you know, it was a kerfuffle, and it was a diplomatic and a baseball diplomatic incident kind of thing with the Hawks, as will repeatedly happened in Japanese baseball. They got into something they didn't really understand, but it used to be a common practice until just a few years ago for Japanese teams to send their guys. And that's how Murakami ended up in MLB. But I had, the list I gave John wasn't in any particular order.
I thought there was an order.
No, there was not. That would explain some of your shock.
Yeah, you gave me this list that hit me with shock and awe here, and yeah, I'm like, okay.
Well, you got
to explain this because this is going to be fun for the listeners. But
No. I'm not quite that radical.
Okay,
I am a little radical. Okay, well, yeah,
I know, and you are a rebel, and I understand that. Yeah. But the point of the exercise was to rank them.
Oh, okay. It said top 10, and I just spilt out 10. So my number one. My number one is Ichiro Suzuki.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. Not
because on the list, everyone on the list that Jim sent me, Ichiro was not number one. He was
probably five or six on there.
You got some explaining to do. Yeah, he was number four. Yeah.
Okay, no, basically durability and more than, you know, and quality, but more than quality, he had unique ability. He was a unique player for his era, and that's really important.
Number two,
Hideo Nomo. And the reason for Hideo Nomo is that the Japanese migration of players doesn't occur until much later without Hideo Nomo.
Correct.
Because without Hideo Nomo, there's no posting system.
Excellent.
Right. Okay. And of course, the guy who threw two no-hitters and he did this.
The numbers and strikeouts speak for themselves. Yes.
Yeah. And they streak out for themselves for a guy who was like as you know, as Sarah said, and although it's really only what he did in MLB, this is a guy who came to MLB as damaged goods. So that's pretty impressive. Okay, I have number three, Shohei Ohtani. Another game changer, another unique talent, and unmatched quality. I don't think there's any, in terms of the value he brings, nobody can touch him. Now, the only thing, of course, he still has not had a long career in MLB, but 5 years is a pretty long career by Japanese standards. So I'm not going to change that. Hideki Matsui, as Sarah said, was a game changer. I agree. Okay. Also durable and a quality, and not just a regular, but, you know, a top three, four guy on the team regular, one of the three or four most valuable players for most of his time with the New York Yankees. Yu Darvish, durability and quality, same thing, ups and downs. And actually, I mean, if you do think about, he has quality, but it's not always been there, but he has become quite a phoenix. You know, he's become so knowledgeable about his body and trying and honing everything that works to become the best athlete he can possibly be for what he's trying to do. He is in many ways, he's the Shohei Ohtani guru, because I think Ohtani's following in his footsteps in that respect. So great on Yu Darvish.
I just have one question, I guess. And you're saying that he has had some downs, but I still have not looked at the numbers overall, but I would say even his downtime is still a very high bar.
It is pretty good. It is pretty good. I mean, but on the other hand, he had his career year when he was 36 years old.
So?
So, well, it's sort of like, it's basically, no, it's not, his lows are not bad. His lows are not bad. His highs are not lights out outstanding either, but consistently and durability, that he's now, of course, saying somebody had a career year at the age of 36 is almost the kiss of death. But, you know, I have, you know, if anybody can get over that, Yu Darvish can. Hiroki Kuroda, same thing. And
he's next. He's number six.
Yeah,
for you?
Number six. I have Hiroki Kuroda, and again, durability and quality. And in Hiroki's Kuroda's, if I call him Hiroki, God, I think he might slap me upside the head
twice.
Could do. He would
turn the other head.
He might. Ouch! Now you're talking pain. Okay. but he wouldn't do that. He might give me a stern look before he smiled. But no, his case is really weird, because this is a guy who basically, I think, he didn't understand the concept of run support until he was pitching for the Yankees, because it was a foreign concept to him when he was
a rumor,
in LA
and
with Hiroshima. I called it an urban myth. He probably thought it was an urban myth.
Correct.
Because he moved from like the weakest offense in the Central League to a really weak, the Dodgers were really weak offensively. So, and then got hit in the head with a baseball just when he was in the prime of his career. Okay. Koji Uehara. Again, durability and quality. Durability, and like Hideo Nomo, this is a guy who's basically, was string had run out in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really make it as a long story. Many stories about that, but this guy to come back. People I talked to saw the comeback with the Red Sox. After he was traded with Texas, and John Stockstill, who was in baseball operations for the Baltimore Orioles, who was that's right, for the Baltimore Orioles, and who was very important in his signing, said, you know, it didn't work out with us. And the Texas, he said, the Texas thing was the Uehara never got the hang of throwing a baseball in the dry, really, really dry air in Texas.
Uh-huh.
And that that kind of foiled him and caused him to be left off the playoff roster his last season in Texas, and allowed the Red Sox to pick him up for, I think they signed, I don't know what they signed him for, but it was really nothing. And they got basically the best closer in baseball for nothing. Then I have a bunch of guys who could more or less not be on the list or be on the list. I have Norichika Aoki.
And at eight?
Yep. And
okay.
And that's primarily because this is a guy who was not, okay, he wasn't never the first or second best player on his team, but he was in that area. He was a valuable regular for a number of years, which is something essentially Ichiro right now, Ichiro, Matsui, and Aoki.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's a small list. Consistent durability, consistent everyday player until he got hit in the head too many times by a team that will not be mentioned. And okay. Then I have Masahiro Tanaka, who, again,
I figured you'd put him number nine. I already put the numbers in.
Yeah. Masahiro Tanaka, durability and quality. Not quality like he absolutely started out with, but gutted it out. I was at the game in New York in 2018 when he became, I think, the first Japanese MLB pitcher to win 10 games in his first seven MLB seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So he said he didn't know it at the time, but he was happy nonetheless. Hisashi Iwakuma, I probably, in retrospect, I wouldn't put it. His no-hitter kind of pushed him over the line in my estimation. But he was, you know, he was a good player, another player who basically got his arm ran over by a truck in Japan and went on and had a pretty good effort.
Figuratively.
Figuratively. And plus, you know, he did that break dancing commercial for the Mariners. So the last thing I would say is that if I had been thinking about peak value only, focused more on peak value, Matsuzaka and Kazuhiro Sasaki would have been there instead of Iwakuma and Aoki, because Matsuzaka had two tremendous seasons. Sasaki was tremendous, but other issues, you know, again, he was not at his best, which this is an amazing thing, because Sasaki's arm basically fell off in Japan. And then he went on and he had a year, he had he didn't even have a half a season off. He had a long break in the off season and he came back and he was really good for the Mariners. So my feeling about him is probably more just, I have weird connection with Sasaki that probably colors my judgment on him.
Okay. All right.
But anyway, well, I thought I loved you, your choices, you and Sarah's choices. So I really enjoyed that.
Well, good. I obviously got your list. There were no numbers. You didn't give me any context. All you did was put 10 names on this email transmission you sent to me. So I went to sleep last night thinking you've got Hideo Nomo number one and Kuroda number two and Hideki Matsui number three and Ichiro Suzuki number four. And I was thinking, you got to explain yourself, young man.
Oh.
So that's what I woke up and spent the whole day thinking that. And then now you tell me you just jumbled them up and put them.
I was just writing down the list. I'm going, I want to include him. And as the names came off, I mean, of course, Ichiro, see, it was less a case of put Ichiro on the list or put him first is thinking of other people besides Ichiro who are on the list.
Well, everything starts with Ichiro. I don't know what you're thinking, so stop that. Don't do that. Just put Ichiro down and then go from there, okay? Don't confuse your buddy John either. It's something I think you did on purpose. You did that intentionally.
I didn't do it consciously on purpose, but it could have been my, it could have been my inner child acting up a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit. All right. So for me, you know, like I said, I didn't use any computers. I still haven't looked at the war. I just think that if you just go and look at the war, anybody can do that. And I think all these players come with context. They come with a story. They come with different situations. And that's why you and I had our 1, 2, 3. Let's see. I didn't rearrange your order. I just put numbers by them. So you've got
Ichiro, Nomo, and Shohei Ohtani.
And our top three are the same, and at number four you've got Matsui. And I would say, if you looked at Matsui and Darvish, and one thing I think you have to factor is the Q rating. You've heard of that, right? Q rating for famous people.
I have heard of it, but I couldn't tell you what it is.
It's basically if you stop people on the street, how many people would know this face? You know, what's your recognition value, or how many people know you. So a lot of people know Michael Jordan and might not have ever watched a basketball game, but they know his.
Well, if we did that, Tanaka and Matsuzaka would be way up.
Right. They have a higher Q ratings, as does if you look at Matsui, because he played with the Yankees. And Sarah said, you know, she had seen a lot of Ma-Kun throwing for the Yankees, so that probably impacted her list more so than mine. And I said, you know, I had him on the list, and as I went through, now it's been a long time. It's been about 30 minutes since you heard my list, so I'll repeat it. I had Ichiro, Nomo, Ohtani, Darvish, Uehara, Matsui, Matsuzaka, Kuroda, Sasaki, and Shigetoshi Hasegawa. And I think if you go on Q rating, I think Matsui's going to beat Darvish out every time, because he's just not that kind. I mean, even in Japan, he might still beat out Darvish, although Darvish is on TV a lot. But Sarah had, during the Baseball Week, Baseball Tonight podcast this past week, noted that Darvish was one of maybe the only pitcher to have signed 3 6-year major league deals with his recent signing of a 6-year deal with the Padres. And so I guess that was since 1990, I believe she said. So if you're somebody who has done something that on that level, that not even, it doesn't matter Japanese born or whatever, it doesn't matter that no one is doing, I had to go with Darvish over Matsui. And the reason I went with Uehara a lot higher is because here's a guy who, again, was so consistent. And you're right, when he went over there, we were thinking he might be a starter. I know that he had done both in Japan, and there was some question about what he would do when he went to the States, but he became such a good reliever. And I do credit guys for winning, because to be an average major leaguer on an average team is not anything special to me. But if you're on a, you know, I had honorable mentions to Tadahito Iguchi and So Taguchi and Ma-Kun as well, because those guys were in winning situations, and it's hard to do. It's not that you can go over and just play.
Iguchi was remarkably effective for a brief time. You know, that was the thing. But a lot of the Japanese infielders all got hurt over there. either like Matsui in his first spring training, or
Kazuo.
Iwamura Nishioka. Let's just pass on that guy. I know nothing mean, dude.
He did get injured. You brought up injury. He did get injured, like on the first play. But yes,
right,
he's among the injured infielders. Correct.
Yeah, and so anyway, yeah, and Akinori Iwamura got, and Iguchi got hurt after their second season. But these guys were really good, and you know, they're the hope I thought about Masataka Yoshida going over at the age of 30, but Iguchi and Iwamura were both that age, and Aoki is a great comp for Aoki is almost an identical comp for Yoshida. I mean, they're not the same kind of players, but they're the same age, and if you about the same kind of, they're basically on base machines, except one can steal and play better defense, and one can put the ball in the upper deck.
I don't know about the better defense, but I'll give you the.
When Aoki was 30, and before he decided, before he decided to stop using his Google Maps to find fly balls. Started taking a roundabout the scenic routes. That's what he was doing. He was taking scenic routes to fly.
There you go. Hey, fastest route, please, and tap that in. Well, this was a really fun exercise. We should have thought about it sooner. And I did ask a couple people at the office, and I also asked our longtime listener and friend Dave, and he sent in a list as well. So he had Ichiro first and Ohtani second, Darvish third. So that's right alongside us. He had, and I told him no computers. So he went with the list off the top of his head as well. He had Matsui at four. He had Nomo five, Kuroda at six, Makun at seven. And he had Kenta Maeda at eight. Uehara at nine, and then Sasaki at 10. And he said, ask me tomorrow, and I might have a different list in a different order.
Same.
So that
Same.
Was the one.
I had the one of the guys who was like, whose performance in MLB is colored by my expectations. I mean, he was valuable for a few years, was Kosuke Fukudome. But again, my expectations were a player of that caliber in Japan were better. So because of that, he wasn't a lot better than, I mean, he wasn't much different from Aoki, to be honest, but I just had higher expectations.
Yeah, it's funny. I still remember you and I, that's one of the conversations that kind of even sparked us to start a podcast, was the conversation we had about Fukudome and Tyrone Woods, and I was never that impressed with Fukudome, and I didn't have those high expectations for him when he went over, because I had seen so many of his at bats and how he stumbled through them, but in situations he was better in certain situations, but I didn't have those expectations for him, and I was not surprised, frankly, that he came back as I wouldn't call it a failure. I just think as unsuccessful as many thought he would be. But we got to move on. We've got to go. I do have some expectations for Yoshida. I'm hoping Senga pitches well, but I don't worry about him, his pitching. I think he's going to get outs. I always worry about his injury situation. That's the thing that I've seen falter,
well,
or seen
current,
damages his.
But he's a, you know, I don't know him well, but I should talk to somebody I know who does know him well. But you know, the word is that he's one of these guys. He's a proactive, Darvish type. Look and learn and trial and error. Everything's always an experiment, and he may be able to find his way. Navigate his way fitness wise through MLB when many of the more NPB or Japanese baseball trained, you know, this is how we train in Japan guys, get hurt by the different routines, that they can't cope with the different routines.
Sure. Well, the other thing is the ball's a little bit different, and it seems like a lot of the pitchers who go over there end up having Tommy John anyway, but he is injury prone in the first place. So that's, I think he'll get out when he's,
I don't think he's going to have elbow trouble, because I think oddly enough, I think his back and his shoulder are the one things that are keeping him from pitching so many innings that he blows out his elbow, needs Tommy John.
Well, sure, but I don't think we can sit here and throw darts at the injury board and see which one's going to pop up. But
Okay, let's go.
Just hope he stays healthy. But and I'm thinking the youngest and the healthiest and the hardest thrower might be Shintaro Fujinami of the Oakland A's. So maybe he has the best chance for success. But we haven't seen
youngest,
him.
He's the same great... age as he's the same age as Shohei Ohtani.
No, I'm the youngest of the guys, the trio of guys who are going over this year.
Yes, slightly.
Yeah, that's what I meant of those. Okay. Not the youngest of everybody in the States. But let's move on. Let's make a four-seam transition and talk about camps. And really, I don't have that much to say about the camps here in MPV. I've been watching the news every day. I think the one thing that caught my eye in these past 2 weeks, because everyone's, and I've recorded some of these camp 3-hour broadcasts that they do, but I don't have time to watch them when I come home, and I have it on at the office. But I mean, you just see guys going through their regular practice, so there's really nothing to be gained by just watching them practice. But we did see Noki Sasaki of the Marines hit about 100 right off the bat in his first outing against live batters this past week. And not only that, I think he went 2 innings, struck out 5. So take some of that. That was impressive. He's ready for his samurai debut.
Munetaka Murakami was going like, this dude's ready now. What's up with that?
Please get him away from me. He's making me look bad in front of the girls, and it's Valentine's Day.
It was the 15th, so no, it wasn't Valentine's Day, but yeah.
I mean, you know, it's Valentine's time. I mean, you know, the girls are still there.
I'm sure they got their share of goodies. The interesting thing, I wrote this in my blog and in the newsletter, but I thought it's worth mentioning that, you know, camp news is pretty dull most of the time. I mean, it's like how many times?
Here's some paint, watch it dry.
Yeah, it's probably, that would be an improvement. So one day when Nikon Sports ran a whole front page of all the Japan national team players changing some aspect of their mechanics ahead of the WBC, I thought, well, it's a slow news day. But apparently people are complaining about it, at least the ones who haven't been able to, like Yoshinobu Yamamoto, who haven't been able to hit 97 miles an hour consistently with their fastball with their new approach. And people are saying, like, these guys are like just changing. And this was in a story about Giants second year reliever Taisei Ota. It's like, people are saying he's, you know, the pitches are nothing. You know, he's just not, whatever he's doing, it ain't working, so stop it. And
yeah, I did see his new kind of flamingo type of delivery.
Yeah. I haven't, but so there was a quote from Dragons manager Kazuyoshi Tatsunami in which he said, Hiroto Takahashi, stop trying to be like Yoshinobu Yamamoto. You're different. Because apparently he was mimicking he worked out with him in the off season, and now he's become his shadow. And he's like,
oh, interesting.
Yeah. So he's like going, you know, you're good at what you're good at. And so, you know, do it your way, which is kind of interesting because, there's a long story to that. I guess to make it short, it used to be that there was a prescribed way for doing everything in Japan. Back when Tatsunami was playing, everything was really regulated. You know, the coaches didn't let players get too weird. That was a 60s thing. And they by the 19
weird.
But well, there was a lot of weirdness, but I mean,
you hippies, this is baseball.
No, I mean in terms of, you know, odd batting stances or peculiar windups, and you know, they were pretty harsh on that. You know, you can't succeed, you know, Ichiro, go back to the farm team where you belong. You'll never make it with that weird stuff. And
right.
But that was the way it was. But Japan's also, you know, the odd thing about that is most of the players, any player who's been playing as a regular professionally for 5 or 6 years knows what works for him or what has worked best for him, and knows that what works for him is not what the coaches tell you to do. It's what you figure out on your own. And this is really, Japan's getting to the point now where, of course, you still say that won't work. You know, the coaches say this is orthodox, but they don't care. They don't mind if you change and do it on your own. But officially, they have to tell you it won't work. Now, you know, fix it, make it better, and, you know, make a liar out of me, basically. But everybody knows it doesn't work. But Japan's stuck in this linguistic and cultural rut where they have to say the prescribed things. You know, this is how we play baseball, and this is how we practice, and infielders throw like this, and hitters hit like this, and pitchers stand like this, but they all know it's nonsense, but they keep saying it because that's what Japan requires them to do. Because if they don't, they'll be criticized, and being criticized is the worst thing that can happen.
Sounds like some aspect of the United States at the moment. So yeah,
it happens. Sure. You're saying. Sure. It's human. It's human nature. It's not like it's something that only exists in Japan, but Japan's kind of got it on steroids. They got that one on speed dial.
Back to speed dial. All right. What about the Samurai Japan news? Now, I just know the biggest thing for me was that Darvish showed up in time for the first day of the Japan's spring, well, not spring training camp, but the WBC training camp session that team is having. And I guess it depends on what report you believe most, because I saw one TV report that said he was on a charter flight. The other one said he took a private jet. But either way, he showed up in time, and he's rock starring it. I give him that.
I tell you. Yeah. Charter, I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised the way the treatment he got last week. I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, he just signed a new contract. You know, he's got big mega bucks.
And
why not?
He just signed a new contract, and they excused him from spring training. They said, you go, well, we trust you. You go play.
Excused him. He probably said, oh, and on my contract, I want this.
That could be.
And I have no doubt.
and the owner said, you want my jet?
Probably. Should I gas it up for you?
That's right. It could have been
like an extra pillow and some mints.
Could have been like the opening, Lee J. Ermey's opening monologue in Full Metal Jacket, except with all the answers affirmative.
Wow. There you go. So yeah, that's the only thing. I fully expect that team to do well. And like I said, you can do well and not win. It is baseball. And when you get to a knockout tournament situation, you know, somebody can have a good day or somebody can have a bad day. So yeah, whether they win or not, that doesn't matter to me. I just think they're going to play well and they're going to have a good showing. And they've got a lot of good players.
I'm going to briefly touch on something that alludes to what a sort of a second reference.
Did you say briefly?
Well, as in, you know, less than 1,000 words.
Everyone laugh with me.
Hashtag hi.
I said briefly. Go ahead, sir.
So what I mentioned, you know, that dichotomy about what you think and what you're supposed to say in Japan. Manager Hideki Kuriyama has pretty much since from day one been telling everybody, we're going to play Japanese style baseball. We're going to pitch and we're going to field, and we'll try to hold on to whatever lead we've got. You know, when they say that, that's the right thing. You know, he didn't say we were going to bunt and play for one run, but that's the subtext. That's what he's saying they're going to do. But of course he's not, because then he gets the lineup with all the big power hitters and all the big power pitchers. And it's not a kind of a Japanese looking team. It's more like an MLB looking team in many respects. Mm-hmm. And so on the first day of spring training, Kuriyama or his coaches put Hotaka Yamakawa, Kazuma Okamoto, and Mune Takamurakami in the same batting group. I guess because they wanted to make sure they had people standing around beyond the outfield fence to catch the balls or something. And and they did that. They put lots of balls in the seats. Okay. And Yamakawa said, you know, the manager told me, you know, swing from the heels, dude. We were expecting you to, you know, like to turn games around with one swing. So that's your job. And so there's that. And then, interestingly enough, and this is the last part, I read a story, an interview with Atsunori Inaba, who was going to manage in the WBC had it been held in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
But did not because it was canceled. And he said, in a definite, he was a coach in 2017 for Hiroki Kokubo, and he was not shy about saying where he thought Kokubo was going in private. He was not shy about saying where he thought Kokubo was on a wrong track, and Kokubo was really stuck on the let's play Japanese baseball kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And he said, when I hear people talking about small ball, I get visibly ill.
Get me a barf bag.
Exactly. He says, I absolutely hate it. And I hate it because it makes big hitters play small. I've been talking with manager Kuriyama. And when I was the manager, when I was Japan manager, he said, you do it, you know, guys got to play their way. Guys got to play their style of game. You manage the way you want to manage and everything's going to be fine. Have a plan, have your plan, do it your way. And then Inaba said, if I picked a team, I would have picked exactly the same team that Kuriyama picked. I'm a believer in hitting the ball hard and, you know, doing all everything else. And Kuriyama's got a team like he doesn't want to talk about. He wants to talk about playing Japanese baseball, but he's picked this really, really pretty awesome team. And I just love that. Okay, that's brief enough. That's long enough for me being brief. But that whole point about what he's supposed to say, like the home run hitter who says, no, I wasn't trying to jack it to pull that thing into the third deck. I was trying to hit behind the runner.
Well, right.
You know, because that's what they're required to say. Nobody believes it, but, you know, it's part of life in Japan. So the Japan team is going to bop and they're going to bash and they're going to mash, but they're going to talk small ball really well.
You know, you say that, but I think that the batters they have also are flexible enough.
Oh, sure.
To hit situational. And I think that'll be the focus when they get on the field, but they have that power stroke in that if they see mistakes and they,
Absolutely. There are guys who aren't power hitters and they've got things that they can play. This team can play any kind of game they want to play.
Murakami as well can handle the bat and that he doesn't have to just try to jack balls.
The only thing they don't really have is defense at all nine positions at once. Because
I still question the bullpen. Yeah.
Yeah. They're going to have either they can have an amazing defensive outfield or they can have an amazing defensive infield, but either third base or left field is going to be, you know, if Ukyoshudo is in the outfield, then Okamoto will be their best defensive third baseman. And he's okay, but he's a gold glove because he is a good hitter.
By fault, yeah. Yeah, I'm with you. All right, so that was brief, and now we'll go to fielding questions.
I don't think I like your tone.
All right, our question this week comes from Dave, our buddy in Baltimore. That's all I remember. I think he told me it was someplace else, but Baltimore is all I can remember, Dave. I'm so sorry. He is a faithful listener, and that's why we read his list. That's why I actually emailed him this week and said, you know, we're doing this fun exercise. I want you to participate. So thank you. But he emailed us right after our previous show. And he says, I listened, as always, to this week's podcast, and I had a question about the WBC. I don't disagree with anything you guys said about the strength of this year's Samurai Japan squad versus the 2013 and 2017 teams, but I wonder if there's another factor that's being overlooked in the failure of those teams. In both the 2006 and 2009 tournaments, Japan played its second round games in the U.S. Mm-hmm. This gave the team a chance to adjust to jet lag and to the time change and playing outside in weather when the team could still lose a game without being knocked out of the tournament. And in fact, Japan did lose games in both tournaments. In 2013 and in 2017, Japan played the second round games in Japan. So the first meaningful games, and I know Japan played some exhibition games in Arizona beforehand, but in North America were the semifinal games that Japan ultimately lost. And not only were they the first North American games, but they were the first games they played outside, and as in non-indoor games, during the whole tournament. So I can't remember what the conditions were in San Francisco in 2013, but I remember it being a rainy evening in Los Angeles in 2017. The winning run in that game was scored when Nobuhiro Matsuda couldn't cleanly field a ground ball hit on wet grass. So, to finally get to my question, do you guys think that this, and this is having to play the first game outside of the tournament and their first game in North America as a knockout game, was a contributing factor to losses in 2013 and 17? And will playing in the final round indoors in Miami help mitigate that as a factor this year? So, hope this makes sense. He says, thanks, Dave. And Dave, thank you. We always appreciate you listening and writing in questions. Jim, how do you want to sort through that?
Well, first I will say the 2013 semifinal was on like the best weather day of the finals games in San Francisco. It was beautiful. It was a beautiful night, beautiful day. So that was not an issue for Japan. It was more an issue of, geez, we didn't think Puerto Rico was going to be any good. And overall leadership and overall planning. But I want to thank you for bringing up a couple of things about, because I had actually also, for even though I was there, I forgot that Japan had played a quarterfinal round in San Diego, and I shouldn't have forgotten because I was there. But
and San Diego's so beautiful. What are you talking about, dude?
It did, and the weather was wonderful, and they did. But the quarterfinal rounds so far have been leagues. This year it's not a league, so that's a problem. And they, I don't know, they had meaningless games in Anaheim the first time because they came within a percentage point of being knocked out in the quarterfinals there. So, but yeah, I think the playing outdoors and adjusting to the weather, adjusting to the time is an issue. This time it's going to be a massive issue because not only do they, not only Japan's going to travel from if they win their quarterfinal against probably the Netherlands or Cuba on March 16th, they will fly to Miami that night, I assume, and they will probably play, they'll play either the 18th or the 19th in, actually I could probably check, they will play the 18th or the 19th in, the 19th or the 20th in Miami. And they don't get any practice games. They're going to have, you know, whatever it is, they're going to have it. And we also don't know whether the roof's going to be open. It's going to be March. It's going to be the end of March in Miami. My guess is the weather's going to be really good. They might have it open. So I don't know what a big factor that was. It could have been one. I've always thought that the biggest factor was Japan not having much MLB experience on the teams. because it forced the Japanese guys to think, the Japanese stars to think they had to carry the whole load.
Hmm.
And then, but you know, even 2006 when Ichiro was there, it was Ichiro and Akinori Otsuka, you know, just those two. It meant a lot. It meant, you know, we can just be ourselves and play our game. And I think the Japanese guys did most of the heavy lifting in 2006 and 2009. It wasn't like the MLB guys carried the load, but they were there. And 2013 was Norichika Aoki, and 2017 was Zero.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, I guess given the hours that these baseball players keep and the fact that they're young, I think the jet lag impacts you more the older you get. But when you're young and dumb and full of energy, I don't think that's a big deal. And I was just talking to Jason.
John, I was young and dumb, and now I'm old and dumb. So I'm not certain that's a corollary.
Okay. No, you're young and dumb. Now you're old and dumber. No. That's mean. No.
That's too mean. But I'll take it.
Okay. I was talking to Jason Koskery, our buddy at the Japan Times, this past week, and I said, look, whenever I go on these trips, I always take my running stuff, and even if it's overseas, it doesn't matter. And sometimes I just need to see daylight. You know, it just needs to be morning. And even though my body knows it's supposed to be, or it's usually in sleep mode at this hour, once I hit the sunlight and I break a sweat, everything's fine. So I don't think that that's a big deal for the players, because they're used to dealing with having to be at their best when their body is maybe sleep depraved a little bit. Mm-hmm. The mental part, because that's the sleep depravity. I think it affects you more mentally than physically. And then the outside part of it, or playing outdoors, I'm not sure that the conditions are, one guy not being able to field the ball was just unfortunate, but he was never a great defensive player anyway. And he was a good defensive player, but I don't think he was a great defensive player.
Yeah, Yosuke Kikuchi booted one as well, and people were saying, see, Japanese players can't play on grass.
Right. So,
one of the only guy on that team who plays on grass.
Yeah. Yeah, they're not thinking. We don't really pay attention to those guys anyway. So the deal is, I think we can make it sound like these guys play in caves here in Japan, but they don't. They play outdoors a lot. They play on different surfaces. They play when it rains. They just have to make the plays when they come to them. And it might be overlooked, and that might be some aspect that contributed to them losing, but they also played some pretty good teams, and you know, it's hard to beat Puerto Rico. They really are loaded with some guys who have a lot of major league experience, especially when you have guys like Yadier Molina behind the plate, who can just dominate a game and mentally impose his will on the entire infield, including his own pitchers, and make them throw pitches that probably they're not used to throwing, but get them to locate and execute and beat you at the mental game and the mental side. So I don't know that it's been overlooked, but it is a factor. So I do want to acknowledge that it is a factor, but I would just have to say my answer off of just what has happened is that you can't win every tournament. And Japan has really done a great job. And if I'm assuming you listen to this entire show and I talked to Sarah, I said, there's so many players on these teams who either end up playing from Samurai Japan, they end up playing in the major leagues, or they're currently in the major leagues. So the talent is there. It's just that baseball games happen that way. Sometimes you hit the ball and there's a guy standing in the way who wasn't standing there the last time you hit a ball there, and the guy catches it. So you can't really blame these losses on any particular thing. I don't think they just lost. And maybe they played against a better team. So we'll see how it goes this time. And again, if the Samurai Japan team doesn't win, I don't think it's a failure. I just think that they just didn't execute, or something's going to happen. But you know, the drama is there to play out. And we just have to watch and see, and we can blame it on the weather.
It's going
to
be fun.
And the time change. But I think it's going to be a super tournament. Looking forward to it. So now our next program and the future still hanging in the air. I did talk to Jason, and one of the reasons I talked to him was to ask him his availability in terms of getting our prediction specials going. So they might come out early. They might come out late. We don't know, but we will certainly try to get them to you and get some content onto the YouTube channel as well. But I'm relying on Jim to get that.
You're such an optimist.
With the video. Yeah, I am. And I'm putting pressure on you here too. Everybody wants to see. He has all the cuts of the Sarah Lang's interview. He only has to put them together, throw some music on there, and send it back to me so that I can post it on the YouTube channel. But we want to thank Sarah Lang's for her coming on. Thank you so much to Dave for his contributions with his list and his email question of high heat. Anyone else who has a question, hit us up at JBW Podcast on Twitter with the hashtag high heat. You can send questions via email like Dave did to yakyujohn@gmail.com. Go to our Facebook page and leave us a comment there. Look for us on Google Podcasts, iTunes, and hopefully we can get some more places going here. And like I said, the interview with Sarah should go up this coming week if you guys want to give her a shout out on Twitter. She is at Slangs on Sports on Twitter. So you can hit her up and at least thank her again for coming on and sharing her thoughts about Japanese players. Jim, anything going on with JBall.com?
Just the typical weekly newsletters. If you like the blog as infrequently as it is during the winter, be sure to register for the newsletter and get a full weeks, a week of various baseball and non-baseball stuff in your mailbox.
All righty. So it's very possible the next time we talk to you, we are doing a prediction special really early. That's possible. It might be just Jim and me. It might be Jim and Claudio and me, or Jim and Jason and me, or some combination of those names, those people above. But it's quite possible we could not have a show for quite a while, or we'll be back next week or in a couple weeks. We don't even know, but we will be back and we'll talk to you next time. Enjoy your baseball.
See you at those WBC camps and things.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBW Podcast and at JBallAllen. And feel free to submit your questions by email or tweet with hashtag high heat. Thank you for listening to Japan Baseball Weekly.